Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. One guest today, Penny Lewis, author of Hard Hats, Hippies, and Hawks, The Vietnam Anti-War Movement as Myth and Memory, recently published by the ILR imprint of Cornell University Press. The book takes apart the myth that the movement against the war in Vietnam was composed of liberal elitists while the silent masses supported the war. In fact, as Penny will tell us, elites supported the war and the working class largely opposed it. This is of more than historical interest. The notion of a liberal elite and a conservative working class is at the core of right-wing populism today, and even a fair number of people on the left believe it. Foundational to the myth is a riot by 200 construction workers in Lower Manhattan in May 1970 who attacked a memorial demonstration for the four students who'd been killed by the National Guard at Kent State. From that, the trope of hard hats versus hippies came to dominate the American political imagination, where it still lives in the form of hating liberals and leftists as latte-drinking, sushi-eating pansies. Penny Lewis teaches at the Murphy Institute for Labor Education at the City University of New York. Penny Lewis. Welcome, Penny. Let's start by talking about how this story about the hard hats versus the hippies thing got constructed. It was pop culture played a very large role, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I would say first moment of it, it was crystallized, obviously, with the hard hat riots in May 1970. But immediately following that, there was this movie that had come out that had already been created about a working class anti-hero, this guy Joe, in a movie called Joe, which depicted this unbelievably bigoted, racist, pro-war, anti-counterculture horror of a guy who single-handedly, although with some help from this middle-class executive in the movie, takes on the counterculture in this really violent way in this movie. And that movie came out within a couple of months of the hard hats, and Archie Bunker also came out the same year as the hard hat riots. And so I would say that at that moment, the image that was created through the hard hat riot itself and picked up in the media and by the Republican Party and other big forces really just then grew to these mammoth proportions because of these pop culture representations that get reproduced and kind of reconstructed throughout the following decades, really.
And, of course, Richard Nixon and his people, like Kevin Phillips, worked very hard to nurture it and then take electoral advantage of it.
Yeah, they saw, I mean, right after the first riots/rallies in downtown Manhattan in May 1970, they saw the possibility of extending this silent majority. You know, this was 6 months after Nixon had made his silent majority speech talking about how there was this silent majority of Americans who were not being spoken for by the protest culture and that he was going to speak for them and represent them. And the way that that was thought about first was the kind of classic Goldwater, Sunbelt, emerging Republican majority of middle America and this large white middle class. With the hard hats, the Nixon administration thought, hey, you know, there were these blue-collar workers who had supported Wallace in 1968. There was something to the possibility of extending the silent majority among blue-collar workers. And immediately, and I don't remember right now whether or not the overtures came from Peter Brennan, who was the head of the building trades in New York City, whether Peter Brennan reached out to Nixon or the Nixon administration reached out to Peter Brennan, but a relationship was created and Peter Brennan, visited.
Made in hell, nonetheless.
He visited the White House. He gave Nixon a hard hat. He went on to become Nixon's Secretary of Labor in the second administration. The Republican Party saw this as a real opportunity for them to claim some, working class support for their policies.
And as a point of demographic fact, the hard hats are actually joined by a lot of Wall Street workers, right?
Yeah, I mean, the eyewitnesses at the time said that there were about 200 construction workers who came up, but then the rampaging crowds that went up from Wall Street to Pace and City Hall were, there were hundreds of office workers who joined in as well.
But then this story of the hard hats versus the hippies really has effects on our politics even today, right? This is not something that is ancient history. This is still consequential.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly when I was, you know, emerging as a political activist in my late teens and early 20s, you know, the story that I certainly was exposed to was that working class people were by and large, you know, angered by the social movements of the 60s and 70s and, you know, wanted nothing to do with protest and had supported the war and were not the allies of protest movements necessarily. And that, you know, the labor movement is also rightly tarred with reactionary behavior from that period. But I would say that the more progressive elements of the labor movement that emerged during the late 60s and early 70s and the kind of strong labor anti-war presence that was eventually created also kind of disappears from public view. So this monolithic image of a reactionary pro-war AFL-CIO was also something that was dominant in my head and was only really shaken at all by the election of Sweeney and the changes that took place in the AFL-CIO in the late 90s. So for a lot of activists, I think that that's the first way that people think about class participation and the possibilities of any kind of cross-class alliances. I know that, I mean, anecdotally for myself, that's true. But I think you see it in all kinds of movie representations and political punditry and observations of what's the matter with Kansas and, you know, why do workers behave as conservatively as they do. There's a deep expectation that workers are going to behave in more conservative ways and have more conservative political attitudes and actions than is necessarily the case.
And by that, we typically mean white workers.
Throughout all of this, I mean, that's a point that I try to draw out, you know, and repeat throughout the book. When the working class was talked about during that time, and today when people talk about workers, overwhelmingly what they're talking about is the white male goods producing and goods transporting working class.
Now, of course, this is not true, or at least fully true. There are shreds of truth to the received narrative. But so let's pick those apart. First of all, the public opinion data at the time did not support the notion that this was a war that was supported by the working class and opposed by the fancy liberals or the upper classes.
No. The way that the public opinion data was collected at the time was that education was often a stand-in for class. And so and we can talk about whether or not that is a totally appropriate way to use or to interpret class. But consistently, the less education you had, the more likely you were to question or oppose the war. And the more education you had up through getting a college degree, the more likely you were to support the war. So people with college degrees tended to support the war, whereas people with, you know, less than high school tended to oppose it. And that's from the very beginning of the war. Over time, people with very high degrees, like postgraduate degrees, ended up being doves. And the people without college degrees were doves. And it was, and this is one of the surprising pieces of data, it was actually males, younger males in their 20s and early 30s with college degrees who tended to be the people who were most likely to support the war.
And of course, this is the picture of the modal anti-war person was a white male college
That's
kid,
right.
Right?
Yes.
And I think you quote someone as saying, if you invert that, you get a picture of the typical war opponent, right?
Right. An older African-American woman was the person most likely to oppose the war.
And there was, of course,
in this polling data.
There was, of course, a very big difference along race.
African Americans were consistently opposed to the war. I mean, not in the very beginning. In the very beginning, most Americans supported the war, and that's pretty typical of wars. You know, I mean, people rally behind the president, they rally behind the soldiers, they tend to follow leaders and follow leaders of public opinion, but very quickly, I mean, civil rights organizations like SNCC and the Congress of Racial Equality, the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party were some of the very first organizations to come out against the war. And civil rights leaders came out against the war early on. Martin Luther King, you know, later than his private concerns, but by April 1967, made his very famous anti-war speech.
Now, he was, of course, nervous at first about derailing the civil rights agenda by embracing a controversial anti-war position.
Right, because in embracing that position, he's, you know, turning his back on the Democratic Party, which was waging the war. So it was an incredibly risky political move for him to make, and it took a long time for him and for other civil rights leaders to come to that place. But it was an incredibly important break. And
then he gave that speech in 67 at Riverside Church, which is impossible, a great, great speech, but it's impossible to imagine any figure of that stature saying something like that now.
It's one of the most amazing public utterances like that I've ever heard. Every time I hear that.
Historical references, it was as true as ever today.
It's so unbelievable. I mean, every single part of that speech is unbelievably true and incredible.
So now let's talk some about the anti-war movement. I was surprised to learn, it's something I'd never thought about or knew about, where there was actually a little anti-war movement almost as soon as the French lost. They were concerned that the U.S. might get involved.
Well, back then, the anti-war movement took this position of, it was very much a kind of ban the bomb, going against the rising anti-communist hostilities. And so the worries for the people who were in this early kind of peace movement was that there was going to be some kind of nuclear confrontation. And so any fight on the terrain of communism, anti-communism, was a fight that they were going to oppose slightly. But there was a big divide in the early peace movement, which was that a number of the early ban the bomb types were also nervous about McCarthyism or responding to McCarthyism or a part of McCarthyism, and they didn't come out against any kind of anti-communist wars. They didn't oppose Korea, and they didn't say much about Vietnam. And that really, I would say, more started to change after 1960 within the U.S. anti-war movement.
But then when the U.S. got involved in the Vietnam War, the early anti-war movement proper was a middle-class movement, right?
In its very first instances, the people who were opposing U.S. policy in Vietnam, and then the very first big demonstrations of 1965, 66, 67, were overwhelmingly middle-class and took place within middle-class milieu. So on college campuses, among kind of leading intellectuals, debates that took place in the New York Review of Books, and senators, you know, a very few anti-war senators and celebrities and the like.
I'm speaking with Penny Lewis, who's the author of Hard Hats, Hippies and Hawks, The Vietnam Anti-War Movement as Myth and Memory, from Cornell University Press. In the early phases of that middle-class-dominated movement, it had some of the characteristics of a middle-class social movement. What are those? What do you mean by that?
Well, I used these different characteristics of the peace movement, and I kind of married that to this idea that movements betray their class composition in the way that they go about organizing to some degree. So what I saw in the early movement, you know, one part of it was this kind of educational project. And the idea was very much that, you know, if we can teach people about how terrible this war is and how wrongheaded it is, then we will change their minds, and in changing their minds, they will act differently. So it's a kind of idealist project, you know, that you get to people through their heads, and you can teach people, like, the way forward. Other aspects that I think have kind of class characteristics, and again, this doesn't mean that, like, working class movements don't do these kinds of things, but that there's a way in which there's a belief that social change happens this way, that reflects middle-class experiences more than it reflects working-class experiences. Another way is this sense that just by being in the movement and by participating in the movement and by committing yourself to the movement, you are changing the world, right? This idea that you have to be the change you want to be in the world. And at the time, what that would mean is that there wasn't necessarily a kind of long-term strategy for, like, well, how is this movement participation going to actually affect the war itself? And again, that's not necessarily middle class. I think that there are, you know, prefigurative movements, for example, that are working class, and there are disruptive movements that are working class, and so it doesn't have to be a kind of working class expression. But the way in which it took place in this early movement tended to, I would say, isolate the protesters from building more firm links beyond themselves. And it was not necessarily always, you know, strategic in the way that it could have been.
But the class composition of the movement changed over the next several years.
Yeah, there were a lot of different vectors of working class participation in the movement. I mean, first of all, working class students joined the movement. You know, if you look at the composition of who was in the movement on the campuses.
Yeah, the image was Harvard, not Salem State, right?
Right, and there's truth to that. It was elite campuses that were the first to move. But one thing that I found really fascinating in sociological polls and surveys that were done at the time, and there were a number of them that were very good, and they looked at who was participating in movements on campuses, and this is, you know, 1965 all the way through 1971. And what they found was that if you controlled for class, I mean, if you controlled for the school, there was no difference in who was participating in any kind of social protest on a campus. So every single person who was on a campus was as likely to be part of a social movement. It wasn't that the more elite students versus the more working class. Protest came from all students somewhat equally, and you couldn't find a class determination of who was going to be protesting. What you could find, though, is that students who went to more elite campuses in the early years tended to be the first protesters. But it was the war that opened up the protests of the 1960s. So, for example, Students for a Democratic Society got its start on mostly, not entirely, but mostly elite campuses in the Northeast. And a few in the Midwest. Over time, that changed, and SDS, you know, exploded and became this incredible organization that was on state campuses and community colleges. And it was the war. It was the protests against the war in April 1965 that was when that transformation took place. So the class composition of the student body protesters was a diverse one. Other places where workers joined the war are within the civil rights movement, within the nationalist movements, and the Black Power movement. Other places is within the labor movement itself, which over time increasingly came out against the war, starting with the left unions, but then moving on to big liberal unions like the UAW, and at that time the Teamsters that joined with the UAW and the oil and chemical atomic workers. They all came out strongly against the war. The GIs, and, you know, I spend a chapter talking about the soldiers and the veterans who were overwhelmingly working class, drawn from the working class through the draft and through kind of, a kind of draft-pushed enlistment, ended up being absolutely critical war opponents, both in Vietnam itself and at home, on the bases and as veterans.
I want to return to the GIs in a bit, but let's talk a little bit more about the home front. There was the draft, which certainly affected elites and the working class differently, or so it seems. What about the draft and the role of draft resistance in opposition to the war?
Well, draft resistance was one of the major places where the anti-war movement grew, and you know, there were a lot of different forms of draft resistance. One of the early groups was this group called Resist. And that was a kind of group of very brave and moral witness where the young men who were being drafted refused and resisted the call to join the war effort. And often they would publicly burn their draft cards. There was a very famous statement called a call to resist illegitimate authority. I don't know if I'm remembering
yes,
the name correctly. my recall for these details. And that was signed by, you know, hundreds of both, you know, intellectuals and also draft resistors themselves. That was a kind of flashpoint for the movement in its early years. What's interesting is that at the same time that was growing, some draft resistors began to question the methods and the framing of draft resistance and the way that it was being conducted, and said the way this is happening is itself elite. I mean, we are, I think pretty consistently, resistors said we are opposed to the selectivity of the draft itself, right? You could get off if you were a college student, you know?
Well, I was in college, 1971, New Haven. And the line on campus was that no Yale student could get drafted if he didn't want to be. Like, there's always a way out.
Right, and that's true. I mean, between, you know, the college exemptions, between the job exemptions that elite students and...
This was even after they lifted the student deferment.
Right. But you could figure out a job, you could figure out, you know, a reason why what you were doing was, you know, necessary at the home front, or you could fill out the conscientious objector applications, which were very difficult to fill out, and you had your lawyer, father, or a friend help you with it, or you could have a medical deferment because you had the friend who was the doctor, or you knew how to fake the symptoms, and you were not being confronted by a sense of obligation necessarily. You know, I mean, you were at Yale in 1971, not in a culture where people were expecting you to answer the draft call. You would be supported in evading that draft.
Yeah, it's like, ha ha, not me.
Right.
That's for somebody else.
And that's not the typical context for working class people. You know, it's not like, oh, of course I can just walk away from the draft. You know, I mean, the draft is a legal binding demand, and you have to meet that demand.
When Uncle Sam calls, who are you to say no?
Right, and, you know, and people's fathers and uncles had served and served proudly, and, you know, that was a part of typical male experience, really, largely working class and middle class, but certainly of working class experience, was to be a part of the military at some point in your life.
But the people who were more actively resisting the draft, burning the cards, or not registering or not showing up, that was mostly a non-elite group, right?
Well, no, I would say most of the people who were actively resisting the draft in the way that you described it, was that was a more elite group than the larger group of people who didn't register at all for selective service, or who practiced, who deserted once they were called up. Those were the groups where you saw more non-elite participation.
We're listening to an interview with Penny Lewis, author of Hard Hats, Hippies, and Hawks, recently published by Cornell University Press. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program Behind the News. Back after a musical break to hear part two of the interview with Penny Lewis. That was some of Class War, the Dills song covered by Mission of Burma. And now back to Penny Lewis, author of Hard Hats, Hippies, and Hawks.
There's a myth that the anti-war movement peaked in 1968 and petered out afterwards. Where's that come from?
From a few different places. Most histories of the period would put 1968 as the biggest rise and most important climactic year of the movements in general. So that is one reason. Another is that it's the year that Johnson stepped down as a result of the war. And so a lot of people say, well, that was the big victory of the anti-war movement, and therefore that is the moment that it reached its greatest power. It's also the year that everybody ran as a peace candidate, and Nixon promised Vietnamization. And so people also tend to think about the war as kind of fading after that, although, of course, it didn't. But troops... You know, it was the peak year of U.S. troops in Vietnam. So I think for all those reasons, there's this sense that, you know, 1968 is the threshold year. And it's also the year that it was like the last year that SDS existed. And a lot of people who conflate the history of SDS with the history of the anti-war movement see everything that happened after that and the splintering of SDS as also meaning the kind of end of that moment of the movement. But the movement itself actually grew and grew larger, you know, all through 1970. And the biggest protests against the war were actually in 1971, when you had the incredible veterans' presence in Washington, and this is when John Kerry made his famous testimony before Congress, and it's when the veterans threw back their medals on the steps of the Capitol and camped out in on the National Mall. But the march that year was, you know, millions large in Washington and in California. And the Teamsters were the marshals, and it had, you know, enormous labor participation, and it showed the real diversity and breadth of the movement.
And so the opposition really had spread beyond its original middle class origins.
Yes.
And it also had spread beyond traditional formal organizational structures, right? The political scientist Jane Mansbridge is working on a book called Everyday Feminism. Mm. And her theory behind it is that social movements start in an organized institutional way and then spread out into daily life and become part of a different sense, common sense. So it sounds like, to some degree, the anti-war movement followed that model.
Yeah, I mean, by the end of the war, you know, the movement was everywhere. I mean, a really great historian of the whole movement is Terry Anderson. I don't know if you read his book that's widely used in colleges, and I think it's a really excellent book called The Movement in the 60s. And, you know, he talks about the kind of pre-1968 versus post-1968 movements. And post-1968, you know, the movement was everywhere. You know, people were just part of the movement, and it meant a lot of different movements. So I would agree with that. And I would also say that
there's also a sense among elites that things were really spinning out of control.
Yeah. I mean, so it's also what preceded, you know, the real pushback, you know, that came in the 1970s. But in the anti-war movement, that was even, I would say the place where that was most true and most really felt was within the military itself. The military is this completely authoritarian, anti-democratic institution. And the experience of Vietnam rattled it, you know, to its very core, and it completely reorganized as a result of that. But here you have this unbelievably hierarchical organization that over time was dealing with soldiers both dissenting against the commands that, you know, their superiors were ordering them, but also directly disobeying, and directly disobeying orders. And there was this practice that was pretty common that they called working out your orders, you know, where the commanding officer would tell the soldiers to go and, you know, occupy a certain amount of space, you know, like go 3 kilometers that way. And they would say, no, we won't do that. And then the commanding officer would say, like, well, how about if you just like get to that ridge? And they'd say, well, yeah, but then we're only going to hold it for, you know, X amount of time. I mean, there was a real back and forth about the orders inside of the military. And that to me is, if you look at the military culture, you see how the common sense of the movement was infusing people who didn't necessarily see themselves as part of the movement, you know, but who were resisting the war and had criticisms of the war and refusing to participate in the war in a largely non-organized fashion.
Now, you said a 1971 paper in the Armed Forces Journal, which I remember reading earlier, which is a remarkable document of the decay of the U.S. military. It's just the level of insubordination, desertion, murder of officers, right, drug taking. It was just the whole institution was falling apart.
Yeah.
As I recall, he made an explicit link between what was going on at home and in the military. It was just two sides of the same coin.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it was impossible to ignore the tumult of the home front. I mean, soldiers were also on these year-by-year rotations, right? So you had always new young soldiers coming in who were leaving a home front that was saturated with anti-war messages and then coming into the horror of Vietnam. And many of them came in, you know, they had to put aside their criticisms because they're fighting a war and they had to survive, and every day was about survival. But they were completely affected by and made cynical a lot of the time, certainly, by the criticisms that they had learned, you know, on the home front. And it seems, I mean, from the memoirs that I've read and, you know, some of the accounts and interviews and news coverage, even at the time, you know, it's clear that there was a kind of high-level anti-war discussion taking place in Vietnam. The protest there was not kind of organized dissent as often as it was at home, but soldiers were receiving anti-war newspapers, you know, which were circulating. There was a really organized GI movement that was reaching out to these soldiers and recruiting them before they left and recruiting them to veterans work when they came home.
And of course, there was the music that was filtering over.
Yes.
So I think the bourgeoisie learned its lesson about it, the importance of having a professional army.
Yeah, they did learn to have a professional army. But this is one of the things that I think makes the arguments that I get at in the book relevant to today. You know, that professional army, as you know, is economically drafted. The majority of people who go into it are either career, you know, come from career military families where it's really deep culture for people to serve, which is true, for example, of my family. I have a number of cousins who have been in the military or who are currently serving. But it's also true that people are recruited because it's the only option they have, and that, you know, their sense is that it's the only place they can go to possibly get a college degree or to advance themselves. And so the working class is recruited to that army. And, you know, I want the arguments of the book to kind of expand the horizons of people who are organizing against wars to see, you know, the working class composition of soldiers today as being a place where, you know, we need to connect and we need to, you know, make a more active attempt at fighting against the war on these class terms.
Actually, which makes me think of the GI coffee houses that were organized around military bases at the time, which is a very active effort to recruit and proselytize among the GIs themselves. Tell us about the scope of that.
Well, there were a number of them on different bases, all, you know, right off different bases all around the country. And, I mean, they were a brilliant tactic because you offered soldiers a place where they could relax, where they could eat, where they could hang out, where they could read things, where they could play chess and just talk to people and meet up with people and, you know, get away from the incredible stresses of base life. And they served as these organizing focal points, you know. So you had activists come and give talks and distribute literature and, you know, just rap with people. I mean, that was the, you know, what people would say at the time, like just hang out and talk to people about what was going on in Vietnam. So I think it was like a brilliant place-based tactic that we could be thinking about, you know, in the work that we do today as well.
And that was definitely not the least bit elitist.
No, no.
Speaking of Penny Lewis, who's the author of Hard Hats, Hippies and Hawks, The Vietnam Anti-War Movement as Myth and Memory from Cornell University Press, drawing a lesson for contemporary politics, I mean, towards the end of the book, you draw the contrast with the Occupy movement, which was not perceived not as widely perceived as a bunch of hippies and did not arouse the real or counterfeit class hostility that the anti-war movement did. Why do you think that is?
Well, Occupy has class-based grievances at its center. You know, I mean, it crystallizes the conflict that we're in right now, you know, which is the extreme wealth, power, and, you know, abuses of the 1% and people who control, you know, the vast majority of the world. And the vast majority of others, you know, the 99 or the 90%, I mean, however you want to actually talk about who's being screwed by the 1%. So the fact that it mobilized around those questions of class and power makes it, in a more obvious way, a different fight than the war, which was a more complicated question for, you know, both workers and middle-class people and elites, and not as clearly kind of class polarized. So I would say that is, you know, one reason why on the kind of surface there's this big difference. I mean, the connection that I'm making is that we shouldn't be so surprised by the ways in which workers were very open to a radical and countercultural fight, because as much as Occupy hasn't been talked about as being like a bunch of elites and hippies, it kind of also has been. I mean, when it was first out, you know, the first coverage of all the Occupy protests was that you know, who are these what are they doing down there? And like, what are those crazy kids doing? And, you know, they all are, you know, so weird, and they're all from all different kinds of places, and they don't really know why they're there. And there was this mystification of it. And I would say that the fact that working class people, again, this is just using polling data, but it's also experiential, having been down at Occupy New York and seeing who was coming through, you know, as early as, you know, weeks of it starting, and the level of labor support and the level of rank and file worker support, you know, at Zuccotti was really amazing, that workers could see through this pretty quickly. And it, to me, shows that the ways in which we've essentialized some idea of working class conservatism, or essentialized some idea that, you know, workers are just going to be skeptical of movements, is completely wrong. You know, I mean, there are reasons why some groups of workers are going to be skeptical of movements. And there are reasons why other groups of workers are going to join movements. And if we look to the past, we see a much more nuanced and, you know, multifaceted movement. And if we look to today, we see a multifaceted movement as well. I think we see more obvious working class support for movements like Occupy, you know, than we see during Vietnam. It wasn't as obvious, although it was there.
This process of essentializing a working class conservatism may have been born around the Vietnam period, but it certainly reached maturity during the era of the Reagan Democrats. And you write some about how the Democratic Party had really lost any reason for the allegiance of the working class. So, like, talk about what happened that gave us the Reagan Democrat, you know, out of Archie Bunker.
I mean, what I try to stress in the book is that, you know, we tend to look at the kind of pull that the Republicans offered to workers, social conservatism and a kind of libertarian, you can own your guns and you know, get rid of taxes and, you know, live in the communities you want to live in, free of, you know, people who don't look like you. And it's this idea that there was this positive attraction, you know, and that's the overwhelming story of why workers became conservative.
Because this is the Tom Frank story.
And that's the Tom Frank story, although Tom Frank very briefly says, although I think underplays tremendously, you know, there was a decade of Democratic Party abandonment prior to that poll. I mean, the Democrats, starting during the Vietnam era, I mean, first they were the party of the war. So that's problematic because people felt conflicted about the war. The Democratic Party became very splintered during this period. The Democratic Party fractured during this period. And there were different wings of the Democratic Party. And I would say Jefferson Cowie's book on the 1970s does a great job, you know, going into detail about the different directions of the Democratic Party and the ways in which organized workers in particular could not or did not connect with these different wings.
Yeah. Well, and then that whole Watergate class that was elected in 74 was either indifferent to or hostile to labor.
Right, and this is the thing. In large part for good reason, because the labor movement, the official labor movement, you know, George Meany and the leaders of the AFL-CIO were horribly reactionary on a ton of questions. I mean, there was some decent labor participation in the civil rights movement, you know, over that period, and there was some decent anti-racism within the labor movement. But the overwhelming leadership of the labor movement during the period was farther to the right than a number of its members. And so workers were disaffected by that. I mean, they were disaffected by their own labor leadership, and then they were also disaffected by a Democratic Party that made, in some ways, very excellent and very important civil rights and social movement kind of progress and put into policy a lot of things that were very important for the movements at the time, but didn't use any of its cultural capital, or not cultural capital, but didn't use any of its political capital to pursue demands that workers had, you know, like increasing the rights of people to organize, like conversion, you know, peacetime conversion for industry, like maintaining regulation of businesses. I mean, the Carter administration, for example, was the, you know, is where deregulation that we associate with Reagan began. So there was a betrayal of core working class concerns on the part of the Democratic Party. There was misleadership from within the labor movement itself, which kind of fractured people. And so you see over time the beginning of these Reagan Democrats. And there was also, and I mean, and I think that this is, you know, central to this whole story, there was also incredible racism that was being both, you know, represented at the top. You know, there was a kind of racist pull of the Republican Party, and there was not sufficient anti-racism, I would say, from within the leading working class institutions of the time, the labor movement. There wasn't sufficient anti-racism within the labor movement to push back against that. So I don't think that most white workers were racist, but I don't think that there was any organized efforts within any of the institutions that they felt connected to challenge racism. And so the big story that I see coming out of this is less why do so many white workers end up supporting Republicans, but more why did so many workers, white, black, brown, stop voting, you know, and just leave the system and feel completely disaffected. And it's that kind of ongoing betrayal on the part of political elites to, and also the elites within the labor movement itself, if you want to call them elites, but the leaders of the labor movement, to really adequately represent
the tops, as the Spartacists say.
Well, we won't call it the top, but the labor leaders and Democratic Party, and obviously the Republicans, to meaningfully represent the kind of complicated both demands and needs of workers.
So, in conclusion, now that you've demolished the myth of the hard hat and the essentialized conservative working class, we now have a possibility of doing things better?
I think so. I mean, I have felt really inspired by what happened with Occupy a couple of years ago. I mean, I think that it showed to me the ways in which a lot of the myths that we have are kind of in practice being overcome. And, you know, my biggest hope for the book is that this becomes part of the conversation and people start to be more conscious about class cultures and the movements that we create and more conscious of the ways in which, you know, people from different backgrounds when working together need to think through how we're going to be coming at an issue based on the differences. And that's an obvious thing that any good organizer worth their salt is going to be thinking about. But I've participated in tons of actions that aren't self-conscious in that way. And so, you know, I've seen among some of the people coming out of Occupy a real energy in that direction. And more importantly, I've seen within the labor movement and within, you know, a lot of the amazing kind of alternative worker organizing that's going on, a willingness to think through the ways in which there are coalitions that go beyond the small groups that people represent and wider interests that they can and we can hone together. I mean, the problem is that right now the reason why a lot of this is happening is because we are so screwed and the challenges we face are enormous. And on some level, I think that the solidarity that I hopefully see around us, you know, or that I see with hope around us is a defensive solidarity. You know, we need each other at a more deep level. And I think more people are coming to realize that we need as many allies as we have. But yeah, I feel like we can do things better.
That was Penny Lewis, author of Hard Hats, Hippies and Hawks, The Vietnam Anti-War Movement as Myth and Memory, recently published by Cornell University Press. In the interview, we discussed Martin Luther King's great speech against the Vietnam War, delivered at Riverside Church in New York in April 1969. It's an amazingly great speech, and it's impossible to imagine something like it today. Here are about 6 minutes of it. Apologies for the sound quality.
That is, at the outset, a very obvious and almost facile connection between the war in Vietnam and the struggle I and others have been waging in America. A few years ago, there was a shining moment in that struggle. It seemed as if there was a real promise of hope for the poor, both black and white, through the poverty program. There were experiments, hopes, new beginnings. Then came the build-up in Vietnam, and I watched this program broken and eviscerated as if it was some idle political plaything of a society gone mad on war. And I knew that America would never invest the necessary funds or energies in rehabilitation of its poor so long as adventures like Vietnam continue to draw men and skills and money like some demonic destructive suction tube. And it became clear to me that the war was doing far more than devastating the hopes of the poor at home. It was sending their sons and their brothers and their husbands to fight and to die in extraordinarily high proportions relative to the rest of the population. We were taking the black young men who had been crippled by our society and sending them 8,000 miles away to guarantee liberties in Southeast Asia, which they had not found in Southwest Georgia and East Harlem. So we have been repeatedly faced with the cruel irony, watching Negro and white boys on TV screens as they kill and die together for a nation that has been unable to seat them together in the same schools. So we watch them in brutal solidarity, burning the huts of a poor village, but we realized they would hardly live on the same block in Chicago. I could not be silent in the face of such cruel manipulation of the poor. Increasingly, by choice or by accident, this is the role our nation has taken, the role of those who make peaceful revolution impossible by refusing to give up the privileges and the pleasures that come from the immense profits of overseas investments. I am convinced that if we are to get on the right side of the world revolution, we as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. We must rapidly begin the shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society, when machines and computers, profit motives and property rights are considered more important than people. The giant triplets of racism, extreme materialism, and militarism are incapable of being conquered. A true revolution of values will soon cause us to question the fairness and justice of many of our past and present policies. On the one hand, we are called to play the Good Samaritan on life's roadside. That will be only an initial act. One day we must come to see that the whole Jericho Road must be transformed so that men and women will not be constantly beaten and robbed as they make their journey on life's highway. True compassion is more than flinging a coin to a beggar. It comes to see that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring. A true revolution of values will soon look uneasily on the glaring contrast of poverty and wealth. With righteous indignation, it will look across the seas and see individual capitalists of the West investing huge sums of money in Asia, Africa, and South America, only to take the profits out with no concern for the social betterment of the countries and say, "This is not just." It will look at our alliance with the landed gentry of South America and say, "This is not just." Western arrogance of feeling that it has everything to teach others and nothing to learn from them is not just. A true revolution of values will lay hand on the world order and say of war, "This way of settling differences is not just. This business of burning human beings with napalm, filling our nation's homes with orphans and widows, of injecting poisonous drugs of hate into the veins of peoples normally human, sending men home from dark and bloody battlefields physically handicapped cannot be reconciled with wisdom, justice, and love, a nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift, is approaching spiritual death.
Now, some of Martin Luther King's 1969 speech against the Vietnam War. Spiritual death, indeed. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, a musical antidote to spiritual death, some of Mahler's Resurrection Symphony, performed by the Vienna Philharmonic under Pierre Boulez. Till next week, bye.